I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. If you love listening to this show as much as I love hosting it, I think you'll really like the Medal of Honor podcast, produced in partnership with the Medal of Honor Museum. Each episode talks about a genuine American hero and the actions that led to their receiving our nation's highest award for valor. They're just a few minutes each, so if you're looking for a show to fill time between these Warriors episodes, I think you'll love the Medal of Honor podcast. Search for the Medal of Honor podcast wherever you get your shows. Thanks. I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words. In partnership with The Honor Project, we've brought this podcast back at a time when our nation needs these stories more than ever. Warriors in Their Own Words is our attempt to present an unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. Thank you for listening, and by doing so, honoring those who have served. Today, we'll hear from Major James Dunning. Dunning served in the British Army during World War II as a commando and fought in the unsuccessful Dieppe Raid in August of 1942. In this first part of his interview, he describes how he became a commando and his engagements leading up to the Dieppe Raid.
When one looks back from being 80 years of age, the reasons for joining that particular time seemed quite trivial. It was in 1937, 1938, when the Munich business was on, and also in the beginning of 1939, conscription was coming in England, and I was working with my father in a family business, and I wasn't all that happy, and one day I thought, I don't know, I've had enough of this. I think I'll join the army. And that's really just how it all happened. Within a few weeks, and the great thing was, joining then, I was there to make my own choice. Whereas if I'd waited another 6 to 9 months, I would have been conscripted and had to join up wherever they wanted to put me. So that was really an impulse before the war, with the war clouds coming, and frustration in the job, and wanting to get away out of a family environment. There we are. And young and foolish, I joined. I wanted to be in, well, I joined an armored car regiment, They wanted the musicians too, and I was keen to play in the band and that, and so it all worked out very well. But then the war came, and that was the end of the that type of thing. It was just after Dunkirk when Britain was alone facing the possibilities of invasion, and having not seen any action, I was then 20 years of age. I was at a training school teaching map reading, and there was a notice for volunteers for a special force. The details were quite brief: able to swim, able to drive a car and a motorcycle, prepared to parachute, and also willing to be transported in a submarine. And still young and foolish, I thought, that sounds adventuresome. And away I signed. I was a sergeant by that time, and this seemed to be a good opportunity to get away from the classroom training place I was in. And I volunteered. And it was simple as that. There were no tests or anything. One was just interviewed and either in or out. And I was in. Each troop leader, having been chosen by the CO, was responsible for choosing his own 2 officers and his own 50 men. And looking back, I think each troop leader had different ideas. But in our particular case, my troop leader, I think, looked for a person who was fit, and in conversation probably conveyed that he had the right ideas of being prepared to have a go at anything. As I said earlier, it was ironic, really, because one wasn't tested on any of the military skills. That came later and was a disadvantage in many ways. as it proved, you know, that we had to then establish a training center. So before the people were drafted in to an operational commando, they all had an acceptable standards of military proficiency and performances. When we volunteered, when I volunteered, the various commandos were set up all around the British Isles, because one of the things that Churchill laid down, who was the prime architect of commandos, that no units could be spared from the vital task of defending Britain. So it was decided that they aim at raising 10 commandos of 500 men, and they would be formed in various parts of the British Isles so as not to denude any one area. And so we were formed in the south coast here, not far from here, about 80 miles from here, at Weymouth in Dorset. And we all mustered there. And the most extraordinary thing about the early commandos, they did not have barracks. No barracks. We arrived as volunteers. We were given a ration card, because Britain, of course, all food was rationed, and an allowance of 6 shillings and 8 pence, that's about 33 pence per day, and told, go and find somewhere to live. It's your responsibility to feed and water yourself, and as long as you're on parade at the right place at the right time tomorrow, no questions were asked. So that was the starting point, and then the initial training was mainly to get fit, physically fit. The routine started with at Weymouth. It was a lovely time of the year, July, beautiful summer of 1940, clear blue skies most days, right on the coast, one to go swimming. And 6:30 every morning while we're at Weymouth, a PT parade, an early morning swim. And then back to our chosen billets for breakfast. And then the morning was spent on weapon training, rifle, Bren gun, bayonet fighting, and weapon skills, and combined with route marches and map reading and so on. And right from the first or second week, we started training for night operations. The blackout was on in wartime Britain, so that, and then there were raids, ACAC and searchlights, which gave a atmosphere of realism for training of the type we were proposing to put into action. Most veterans will look back and they will say, without any shadow of doubt, that their most arduous and mentally taxing pieces of the training were the speed marches. And it was not so much, well, just as much physical, but equally mental. You've got to make that mental barrier when you go on, when the flesh is inclined to give in. It's a mental thing, it's in the mind. And that was the toughest part, the speed march. Looking back, the first few months, no, I think most people found it progressively acceptable, but those who couldn't make the grade without any compunction were returned to their own unit, whether it be infantry, tanks, artillery, or whatever. That was a great thing throughout all commandos, the RTU system, return to unit. If a person was physically unable or mentally unable or a whinger, a moaner, and didn't fit in with the team, he was, without any redress whatsoever, RTU'd. We were the first people, after Dunkirk, to get the United States Thompson submachine gun, which we had previously only seen in James Cagney films and Edward G. Robinson. They had a tremendous impact on the weapon training, because being a short-range carbine, it fundamentally fired from the hip and in small bursts. And once we got those, we said to ourselves. Right, we fire this weapon from the hip. Why can't we fire a light machine gun from the hip, the Bren gun or the rifle? And that all fitted in with the development of aggressive, offensive methods of fighting, because previously a lot of the weapon training had been done on what you might call World War One and Boer War style of training. Adapt a nice firing position on the ground, everything fine. And it wasn't really geared for modern warfare, where you had to fire your weapon under all circumstances and from all positions. A Bren gun was a light machine gun which had been invented in Czechoslovakia in the mid-30s and was adopted by the British Army in the late 30s as the standard infantry light machine gun to replace the old Maxim and an in-between the rifle and the Vickers machine gun. So basically we had just the basic infantry small arms, rifle, Bren gun, Tommy gun, and a variety of grenades. Later on, when the role of commandos was altered, we had heavier weapons. First of all was the 2-inch mortar, and then the 3-inch mortar, and the Vickers machine gun. I have omitted one very cumbersome weapon which we had, and that was known as the Boys anti-tank rifle. A very unpopular weapon, heavy, fired a armor-piercing round, had a kick like a mule, the actual gun. It was bolt-operated, and it was very useful for against light tanks, but mainly used against emplacements and pillboxes and that. And that was eventually replaced by a Piat, which was a projectile, which fired a shell, which a hollow charge, which punched a hole into a tank or an emplacement. The Fairborn and Sykes, they're amazing characters. Fairborn and Sykes, two Shanghai policemen. They came back. They were quite middle-aged men. We thought they were quite old. And they came to a place called Loch Islet, which was the forerunner of Achnacurry, and up in the highlands. Loch Islet was started almost by accident. Loch Islet was the first special training center in Britain. And it came, as I say, almost by accident, inasmuch as in late 1939-40, the Russians had invaded Finland, and the British government decided to send a small token force to help them, the Finns. And so they called for people who could ski. And as one would expect, most of the people that could ski were people who had the means to go skiing before the war, which was very limited. And as a number of, well, some several hundred people volunteered, but they were mainly officers. And they were, unless they were a regular officer, they had to relinquish their wartime commission. But anyway, they were got together, sent to the south of France, trained with the Alpin chasseurs, the French mountain troops, and then they came back. And when they came back, unfortunately, by that time, the Finns had capitulated and there was no need. And among these people that had volunteered were some very adventuresome types. There were two brothers called the Stirling brothers, one who became the founder, well, he became a commando and then a founder of the SAS and other characters like that. And they decided that they would spend their leave up in Scotland at one of the lodges of the Stirling brothers in the Highlands. And while they were there, they had what you might call an ear in the corridors of power. And they decided they'd try and get a private army to do a raid in Norway. And they set off. They did get a submarine, but it broke down and they came back. And when they came back, they said, well, we must get together and start a special training center. And that's how Loch Islet was started. And among the people they dropped very quickly were these two ex-Shanghai policemen, Fairbairn and Sykes, who had started the Shanghai Riot Squad, and they introduced unarmed combat, close quarter combat, to the British Army, and also introduced the famous FS fighting knife, which is here today. I went to Loch Eilet and did a demolition course under a man called Mad Mike Calvert, who would claim to teach you to blow up everything from a brigadier to a battleship. And so, but while I was up there doing my demolition course, I had sight of and rubbed shoulders with people who were doing that particular course as opposed to my course on demolitions. Mad Mike Calvert, he was a sapper, a Royal Engineer, and he was a qualified explosive expert, and he taught explosives until after the Loch Eilet got established. A lot of instructors like Stirl, when the commandos were formed, because the Loch Eilet was formed before the commandos, but only a few months. They got established, and some of them, like the Stirling brothers, Lord Lovett was up there, he taught field craft, and that they decided to volunteer for commandos. And Mad Mike, he didn't initially, he kept on teaching demolitions, and then they decided they wanted some of these irregular warfare expert tutors to go to the Far East to help with Wingate and the Chindits. And Mad Mike then left Britain, left Loch Eilet, and went over to the Far East and became a commander of one of the columns of Wingate's first expedition in the jungle. But he was a mad character, and hence his nickname, Mad Mike. FS knife was a fighting knife invented by Fairbairn and Sykes, nicely balanced. It became and still is the emblem of the commandos. The Royal Marine commanders of today have their shoulder thing of fighting knife. And Fairbairn and Sykes taught one how to handle the knife. I would say it was very rarely used in action, but it was one of those things which inculcated the right fighting offensive spirit, which was possibly lacking in the wartime, in the peacetime army. One of the great moans that I always have is that the peacetime army in Britain, of which I only saw the last few months, got one fit to play games and rugby and tug of war across country, but not fit to fight. I'll give you an example of that. When we first started in commando, the cry would go, or sergeant would say, right, get ready for PT. And people would change into shorts and a singlet and brown canvas shoes to do PT as though they were at school. That was wrong. We said, no, this is ridiculous. You want to do PT in your battle dress, your boots, not have Indian clubs for arm exercises, use your rifle, and so on. And that was another example of bringing up to date and getting chaps to think in terms of preparing to fight as they have to fight. And Fairbairn and Sykes brought that in. They said, you'll probably end up without any weapons sometime. You've either got to disarm your enemy or know how to either kill him or maim him or put him out of action without a weapon. And therefore, you look around. What you've got? You've got boots on your feet, you know, to use. You can use your hand in a certain way and so on. And this is all part of creating that spirit, that offensive spirit, which became known as the commander spirit. His Sykes was the judo expert, but both had got what was called the black belt in judo, and I think one of them, I can't without looking at record, Fairbairn possibly was the first foreigner outside Japan and had a black belt. The original ones, the chaps that joined up in 40, it was an ongoing thing. We were being prepared for operations while we were still really training. And as a result, the earliest raids weren't successful. They were good propaganda because people did land on the enemy coastline, but they weren't really successful. It was a different feeling, I should imagine, later on when the training center was established and there was a course of 6 weeks to go through to get your green beret. Because initially, until the first 2 years from 1940 to 42, we didn't have a green beret. We all wore our own regimental headdress, whatever it was, a tam o'shanter of a Scottish regiment, a fore and aft cap in the cavalry, a black beret for the tank people, and so on. So for us in the early days, we were in commandos, and so it was just ongoing. We didn't feel really any different after that training than we did initially, but we knew we were better. Whereas from 42 onwards, the chaps that came in had to go through the basic training and weren't a commando until they passed that. The early chaps were commandos from the start. Subtle difference.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Well, the first big one we went on was successful, the Lofoten Island ones. The Boulogne one, it started off badly. We were towing some landing craft across the channel from Dover, and I think it was three of them. And in sea troop, we had two chaps in the landing craft, and it got awashed going over and subsequently sunk. And as a result, the guys in that landing craft were drowned. But there were only two. It has been said by someone, and I've heard that it had been reported in a recording at the Imperial War Museum, that there could have been as many as 30. But that is not true. I was troop sergeant major, second in command of the LCA, which would have been loaded, and we lost just the two, no more. I can remember their names, Crump and Hoodless. Anyway, we did land there. Our particular role was to create a beachhead. And so that was our main task. The other troop had landed, B troop, had a variety of objectives, to catch a prisoner, and they had with them some experts who wanted to examine a certain installation or a type of defences of this installation. But I personally was not involved in that. It wasn't a spectacular raid like the Foughton raid, where you saw positive results, but it certainly, according to the CO and his report, successful in a limited way. But it was unsuccessful in as much as we didn't use the right techniques for taking our landing craft across in the first attempt. The idea behind the system was to have no tail, no administrative tail. Every infantry battalion, to keep the battalion on the road, as it were, has to have cooks, orderlies, has to have guards and all that sort of thing. Well, if you have a system whereby you give the soldiers or lower people in the unit a ration card and some money to find their own billets, especially as all the commanders except one were founded in seaside resorts for two reasons. One, you had access to the sea, and there's often small boats, fishing boats or small craft to practice seamanship. And B, you had availability of lodgings in places like that, which weren't being used because of the war, but would be available for billeting soldiers and landladies accustomed to providing breakfast and an evening meal for their seaside visitors. So that was fine. And that worked very well. Because we got 6 shillings and 8 pence, which was a third of a pound sterling, other units, other people often thought, outside commanders, it was extra pay, but it wasn't. That was for our subsistence. So that myth had to be exploded later on during the war. It worked very well. It meant that unlike an infantry battalion, you had 100% of your men available for training. And Colonel Darby of the US Rangers, after they had come over to Britain in 42, they had gone to Arachnacarry, which was followed on after Loch Islet, and had to marry up with one commando to prepare for the North African landing. And Colonel Darby's on record as saying it was a tremendous boost to the morale of his men. And for the first time, he had all his cooks and other batmen and all those sort of things out training because they had a ration card and he had 100%. And he said it was tremendous. And it gave the men a lot of initiative. Instead of being in barracks and told to get on parade in 10 minutes' time and this and that, they had to do it themselves. They had to think about it, where they were going to be, what the equipment they were going to take. And so it stimulated initiative. To be able to react to any given situation within the framework of the main aim, to destroy the enemy. Compatible with self-sufficient was the need for each individual to be part of a team. And the smallest denominator for the team was two. So we introduced what was called me and my pal, which I think Americans later called me and my buddy. And then the two became a self-contained unit. And invariably, they shared a billet together. If they were on the Brendan, they were automatically the number one and the number two, and the mortar, number one and number two. So to go back to your original thing, self-sufficient, able to cope with a situation and respond to a situation with full confidence. Confidence in the order that's given, because there has to be a mutual respect and loyalty between the leader of whatever rank, whether it's from the officer down to the section sergeant to the lance corporal in charge of a little group, and to have that trust and mutual respect, which came through all the various aspects of training where leadership at all its levels came out, like mountaineering, rock climbing, a dicey situation in the water, and so on. It developed in training and was probably more applicable in training, because when you did a raid and came back and then trained again, you had chance to cement any losses. But when the commandos, like in Normandy, where they were in the line for 90 days, the system to a degree broke down, because one might get killed and then your buddy had gone, you see. So you then have to try and get another link, and possibly you became one of three or something like that. So it was an ideal situation, mainly for the purpose of training, but it did stand the test of action, but it was liable to be broken up. And of course it could have, if you were very devoted to your buddy of power and you lost him, it could really tear a hole in here. And so there was a danger there, but that was met by, you would, another couple would say, well, we'd look after old George, you know, he's left old, lost Fred, we're having with us, you know, and then the reinforcement would come in and heal the gap. Oddly enough, in commanders in particular, we often used to find that a bloody good soldier that is a little bit bolshy and, you know, is always moaning, we'd often, especially in situ, I remember quite a few, and George would know them, we'd say, I'll tell you what we'll do, we'll give him a stripe, make him a lance corporal, give him some responsibility. And then instead of being a whiner and a moaner, he had to pass on the orders and he'd explain why it was necessary. And I can think of two chaps in particular who could have been a bit of a nuisance. And we gave them stripes, gave them a bit of responsibility, and they reacted and it did the trick. Initially, the concept of commando raids were small raids. The chap in charge of overall charge of small commandos was a great buddy of Winston Churchill, who'd been a great leader in World War I called Sir Roger Keyes. He, towards the end of 40, he had the idea that we should go for bigger raids. And he got the ear of Churchill, and they planned, while we were all up in Scotland, a big raid in the Mediterranean to capture an island called Pantaturia in the Mediterranean, which would be used as a base to operate against the Italians supplying North Africa. In the event, it was cancelled, although the commandos were sent out there, and that's another story. Following on that, the chiefs of staff and the economic advisor decided that there'd be a big raid in Norway, because the Germans who were occupying Norway had developed factories in the north of Norway where they were converting fish oil, cod oil, into a component for nitroglycerine for explosives and sending it back to Germany. So it decided to carry out a big raid, two commandos, number three and number four, to the islands of Lofoten, up one into the Arctic Circle, and destroy these factories and the fishing fleet which were producing this substitute for nitroglycerine. So off we went. We stayed at Scapa. We had detailed plans I was then a sergeant in F Troop, and we had a specific task. I had to land with my little group, and I had a house to go to, and to get at a chap who was the manager of a little factory, and he would take us into the factory, and we would destroy everything in there. And all of us had tasks like that. Another troop had to go and surround a little barracks where the Germans were located and either capture or destroy them. And so the landing, which was up the field, was carried out with complete surprise. We were all dreading it. Well, not dreading it, but apprehensive that we'd be shot up going in, but we weren't. We got in with complete surprise. And the whole raid, it sounds almost fantastic. We destroyed something like 16 or 17 factories. When I say factories, they were small units, not great big things like you're used to in the States, it's called factory, but they were producing this oil. And it was stored in great tanks. And we destroyed something like 800,000 gallons of this oil. We sunk with explosives and depth charges something like 18 ships. We captured 200-odd German prisoners. And we brought back 300 Norwegians without one single loss. There was only one person injured, and that was an officer who shot himself in his leg, taking the holster out from a leg holster. It was a fantastic achievement, and is often decried because it was no fighting hardly. But the group that captured the main group of German prisoners got to this small barracks, where over 100, and they surrounded it, and it was just before their reveille. And they knew that they had a sort of parade, first thing, and they waited until they paraded before they fired. And the Germans had no weapons with them. They weren't expecting. It was the most extraordinary success story, that, which, because it was no battle, has often just been neglected. So that was the Lofoten Islands. And of course, it was a great boost to morale back here. Bring back 200-odd prisoners, see them landing, you know, in Scapa Flow, because it was a time in March 1941 when there was heavy blitz in London. So it was a good morale booster.
That was Major James Dunning. Next time on Warriors in Their Own Words, he'll describe the infamous Dieppe Raid and how he became an instructor at the Achnacarry Castle. To learn more about Dunning and his experiences, check out his book, The Fighting Fourth. The link is in the show description. Thanks for listening to Warriors in Their Own Words. If you have any feedback, please email the team at kharbaugh@evergreenpodcasts.com. We're always looking to improve the show. For updates and more, follow us on Twitter at @team_Harbaugh. And if you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to rate and review. Warriors in Their Own Words is a production of Evergreen Podcasts in partnership with The Honor Project. Our producer is Declan Roars. Bridget Coyne is our production director, and Sean Rule Hoffman is our audio engineer. Special thanks to Evergreen executive producers Joan Andrews, Michael DeAloya, and David Moss. I'm Ken Harbaugh, and this is Warriors in Their Own Words.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis, introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.